morning, George.
Good morning.
Good morning,
George.
Good morning, George.
I'd like to call the meeting today, order today for April 11th, the Environmental Resources Policy and Finance Committee. Welcome everyone for being here. Okay. Representative Schumacher is tardy. Well, we have the minutes before us from April 10th. Representative Clark Johnson, would you care to move the minutes from April 10th, please?
Yes, I'll move those minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Have any minutes before you? Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes as presented, please signify by saying aye. Aye,
aye.
Good. You beat me to it. I like that.
Aye.
Good. We've got a lively bunch here this morning. Oh, good. Well, Representative Schumacher, welcome. Nice you could make it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today's bill is adjusting some of the regulations for MPCA on the new open air swine basins. What we had is I had an issue with a constituent.
Yeah, okay. Representative Schumacher, I will move that we lay House File 3216 over for possible inclusion. Okay. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what happened is they had built a truck wash and were finding that they were being regulated as an open-air swine basin. They didn't want to do that. They talked to MPCA. MPCA really didn't want to do that, but that's the way the statute was set. And so they had come to an agreement, and we've been working with the department to get this regulated in the right way. And so that's where we're at. And I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Clark Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This really isn't a question, but Representative Schumacher, we hear a lot about common sense legislation. This is one of those, and I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Yeah, very good. It's too bad we have to have legislation for common sense, but that's good, especially if it's Northwest Minnesota common sense, right? Anything else? Okay, very good. With that, Representative Schumacher, any final statements on your bill?
No. Nope.
Very good. Thanks. House File 3216 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, House File 4070. This is the Chair's bill on demolition landfills, and I would like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like. I have a couple of testifiers that can be coming down while we're doing that. Those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. So, members, we're working off the DE2 here today. This is an issue that's been brought to me, the demolition landfill stuff. We started some last year, and we're trying to create a little more certainty, trying to eliminate a lot of possible confusion and so forth with regards to re-permitting demolition landfills. We passed a bill last year that we thought would give them some relief for 5 years. There continues to be a great deal of frustration in greater Minnesota. The demolition landfills are there's 60 some of them around the state and many of our rural districts, and the people want to do good things. We have some guidance documents and some rules in place for re-permitting, and as I said earlier, there continues to be a significant amount of frustration. We've been working with the agency for some time, trying to come to a better place from their perspective. I'm representing my constituents, and with that, we'll go to the testifiers. Roger Schroeder, if you're here, from Lyon County. Roger is the environmental administrator in Lyon County. I've worked a lot with several different environmental administrators in Roseau County, Lake of the Woods County, and so forth. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Representative. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Mr. Chair, did a great job of summarizing why we are here. The demolition landfill history, at one point we realized that this material could be managed in a manner that is less need for restrictions as the material going into a municipal solid waste landfill, for example. I'm here not only as the Lyon County Administrator, but I am also representing the Southwest Regional Solid Waste Commission, which is a joint powers agreement with 12 counties in our region, as well as the Landfill Operators Group, which is an association of landfill managers and permit holders throughout the state of Minnesota, and I am its current president. Our support for this amendment, Mr. Chair and Representative, stems from recent experiences as a permitted community of Class 1 demolition landfills in which new requirements have been added during the permit renewal process specifically. Our position is that the MPCA has not been accounting for social and economic factors for some of these additional requirements that can end up being quite costly for a smaller county such as Lacaparle County, for example. We also feel the MPCA has not been taking into consideration the feasibility and practicality when adding some of these new permit requirements such as a liner and leachate collection system, excessive cover material as part of their enhanced daily cover, or enhanced final cover material, or adding groundwater monitoring wells to a facility that is already in compliance with the 2005 guidance document monitoring strategy. We believe these new permit requirements are also not based entirely on the agency's 2005 demolition landfill guidance document. The result of this, Mr. Chair and Representatives, is that there is a little bit of unpredictability in the activity, and that creates uncertainty among us permit holders. Not really sure when we hear a story of one permit holder going through a renewal process and having to expand their groundwater monitoring, and then the next permit holder during the renewal process is required to have 5 feet of cover material over their waste. It creates a little bit of uncertainty as to what's coming next, and are we going to, as a permitted community, have time to work into our budgets the necessary or potential requirements that is going to be required by the agency. Many of the permit holders have commented to me some of these situations. We're supportive of operating our facilities in accord with promulgated rules, but feel that some of these requirements are outside of that box, as it were. Representatives, we do share the agency's desire to protect groundwater. However, our association of landfill permit holders, especially the Class 1 demolition landfills, and the engineering community that serves us in management and design of these facilities, we believe that the agency, in its evaluation of groundwater data, has not specifically precluded the possible influences from either the soil material that the site resides in, where these groundwater monitoring wells are picking up different constituents, or possibly in some cases from previous activities that are in close proximity, maybe even upstream or upgradient from a permitted demolition facility. For example, an unlined MSW landfill, possibly in the closed landfill program. So we feel that the MPCA has not precluded those possible factors when evaluating the groundwater data. Now, that being said, Mr. Chair and Representatives, we strongly support the provision of requiring a groundwater study conducted by an independent entity, and believe that's critical to understanding the relationship these Class 1 demolition landfills have with groundwater resources. Understanding that data truly is imperative to properly regulating these facilities. You know, we're sympathetic to the agency's need to assure the public that these Class 1 unlined demolition landfills do not pose an environmental risk. We don't want them to be an environmental risk, or the managers of them. But we do feel that the agency is prematurely responding to the data that they've reviewed and not entirely based on science. Mr. Chair and Representatives, we believe your support of this amendment would alleviate the uncertainty that we experience as a permitted community. We're reasonably trying to manage these landfills, but sometimes feel blindsided by the regulations or the permit requirements that are being written into the renewal process. In addition, support of this amendment would go a long way to helping our local county commissioners who, in their long-range planning, want to provide a low-cost service of these facilities to their residents, whether that resident is a weekend warrior doing a home improvement project for the house, or in the unfortunate event that we experienced in southwest Minnesota in 2011, where straight-line winds caused significant damage to homes and large volumes of vinyl siding, shingles, and wood waste had to be quickly disposed of at our online demolition landfill facility. These facilities serve an essential function, especially in Greater Minnesota, especially in the rural areas where transportation costs can get quite high if a facility is unable to continue operation. With that, Mr. Chair and representatives, if there's any clarity I can provide to any of my comments, I'd be glad to do that this or later. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilkins, you had your hand up for a question. Did you have a question of Mr. Schroeder? Is it Schroeder or Schrader?
I pronounce it Schrader.
Schrader.
Thank you.
Did you have a question for the testifier, or was it something to the bill? Because I do have MPCA to come down and testify as well.
I could for the...
Yep, absolutely.
Because one of the things that you said was, Mr. Schrader, that what's going into a demolition landfill is less likely to create problems for the groundwater. Am I hearing that correctly?
Mr. Schrader.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. At one time, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, we as the solid waste community and the agency recognized that this waste was thought to contain less harmful substances, wood, a 2x4, shingles, for example, and that it could be managed in a different way than the household hazardous waste that was going into the landfill at that time or other industrial waste. And so that was my point.
Well, then do you take out, so you're demolishing a house or a barn, do you take out anything that may have lead in it before it goes into the land, before the waste goes into the landfill?
Mr. Schrader.
Lead paint is what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. We have inspections that are done on homes either by a private contractor or by the solid waste administrator in some cases, and we expect that before that home is demolished, the mercury thermostats, the lead piping, furniture, other appliances, or everything is taken out of there that could possibly have hazardous waste containing materials.
Representative Walking, yes?
No, I was specifically speaking of lead paint, like a house can be painted with lead paint.
Sure. Mr. Schrader.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative, no, that is not a requirement for the lead abatement in some areas. We try to do the best we can in managing that, but sometimes when the house gets taken down, it's the paint and everything along with it.
I
hope we do have the MPCA coming down because lead. So there is a lead is very dangerous for children, and we haven't said anything about how close somebody's drinking water well might be to a landfill, and I don't know whether there are any measurements of that and how we protect neighbors who, particularly neighbors who have children. So I'll have my next question for the PCA. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Schrader, members? Yes, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schrader, can you tell us who's allowed to bring debris to those sites?
Mr. Schrader.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative. Any member of the general public or contracted waste hauler is allowed to bring that material.
Mr. Sundin, or Representative Sundin, excuse me.
Thank you, Chair. To that point, contractors are trained, to mitigate dangers to Representative Wagenius' concerns about lead, asbestos, and those types of materials, and they're somewhat regulated on how they handle those materials. And I don't believe that the general public, let's say if I wanted to dump some demolition debris there, those standards don't apply to me. Can you speak to that, please?
Mr. Schrader.
Yes, I should add, Mr. Chair and Representative, that as part of operation of the demolition landfills, we are required to have a certified landfill operator on site. And so that landfill operator should be catching the materials that are not permitted to be disposed of at that location, whether it be lead-based paint on siding or carpeting or other materials that are in the guidance document under the unacceptable materials list. And I failed to mention, Representative, that not only is that landfill operator on site, but every landfill manager has the opportunity to reject materials from entering their demolition landfill. In our situation, for example, we have both an unlined demolition landfill and a lined MSW landfill, and we are frequently having to pull green-treated lumber, carpeting, paint cans, etc., from the person disposing their load and rejecting that from being disposed of in the demolition landfill and sending them over to the solid waste landfill for disposal.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking forward to hearing some comments from the MPCA on this as well.
Thank you. Representative Karen Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Virginius, this question made me think of another situation, and when you were talking about the troubles with people losing their shingles and so on off their roof, there's also the asbestos issue, in some of the exterior siding. What is that, something that you watch out for too, or what is your...
Mr. Schrader.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. At our facility, for example, we are not allowed to take asbestos-containing materials, and so we require that a certified inspector go out to that site and validate that there is no asbestos-containing material before it comes to our facility. Now, there are some facilities that are permitted to accept asbestos, and I can't speak to what their requirements are.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can say that, like in Roseville after the flood of 2002, we had a mountain of demolition debris that needed to be disposed of, and it was very time-consuming and costly, to get rid of that because of asbestos concerns and lead concerns and so forth, and people's houses were literally destroyed. And then, but you still have to get rid of this stuff, and it's a troubling situation. I think what I'm trying to do in this bill is to make sure that what we're going by is the guidance document that's represented in the bill on line 1.10. It was done in 2005, and then the current rules. And then, of course, the groundwater study that's referenced in Section B of the bill or in the amendment in the bill now, that we have the agency completing that report by November 1st of 18, and we discussed yesterday possibly extending that date out later, and we're certainly willing to continue working. That's one of the folks on the list here, Representative Metza. Representative Wagenius, to that point?
No, another point.
Okay. Yep.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Schrader. I just wanted to say I was in the midst of a remodel with my wife on a rental property that we have, and I know our landfill was... she's pretty good at it, Mr. Chair. Definitely keeps me on budget. You know how us Democrats can spend. In all seriousness, I was very impressed with the staff at the landfill and had talked to the MPCA about some of the concerns over the course of the summer that they had brought up with some of the processes in place. But when we had our siding, we knew that there was lead paint on it, and so did the inspector there. And it was separated, put into a separate container to be dealt with appropriately. We had some asbestos-covered pipe, which we had to be very careful in bagging properly. They gave us the instructions in how to do that. It wasn't a lot, but it was a very thorough explanation and detailed information that we were able to gather right from the folks working there. And so I think, the general public can be getting that, assuming that other employees around the state are doing the same thing in their landfills. And I just wanted to give a shout out to those public employees for doing their due diligence and making sure that, at least in our neck of the woods, that things were getting dealt with properly.
Mr. Schrader, comment?
Just appreciation. Thank you for that comment.
These demo landfills provide an extremely important function of everyone. everywhere, in particular in rural Minnesota. We mentioned mileage and so forth. If it becomes so costly to re-permit these facilities, I've been told by a number of different entities that they're just going to close it because they can't afford to keep them open. And then, members, the issue that I'm trying to avoid is then having some form of disposal going on that is, number one, illegal, number two, is not friendly to the environment, and just causes all kinds of problems. And if you're going to have to travel 130 miles to get rid of demo debris, there's a lot of that stuff that's going to wind up in a hole, over a bank someplace, back in the woods, and we don't want that. You know, we want these things taken care of appropriately. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear the problem. I mean, we have an old farmhouse, too, and Douglas County actually does quite a good job with our everything we have, and that's a lot of stuff. But my question to you, and maybe it's for PCI, I don't know, who has the liability? I mean, say a well next door is contaminated, who then has to pay for a new well or to put on a whole house filter or whatever? So there is the question of liability here, and I don't know the answer to it.
Sure, and maybe Mr. Schrader can answer that, but I'm going to ask MPC to come down now too, Mr. Kadelka, thank you at this time. Mr. Schrader.
Well, my comment, Mr. Chair and Representative, will be that's up to the lawyers to decide.
Yeah.
and I would imagine that there would be a responsibility on part of the permit holder for rectifying that situation, Representative.
MPC, would you come down, please? Assistant Commissioner Kadelka and Assistant Division Director Benke. And thank you, gentlemen, for being receptive to my concerns anyway. I appreciate that, and I know that this is a touchy issue, and we're trying to work through it, and I appreciate the time that you've shared with me, which has probably been way more than you want to, so thank you. Representative Wagenius, would you like to re-ask your question, or guys, can you just answer the question? Identify yourselves, maybe you can answer the question on liability for Representative Wagenius and the rest of the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Benke. I'm the director of the Resource Management and Assistance Division at the Pollution Control Agency. I think that to start with, the answer to Representative Wagenius' question is with the permittee. The permittee is required to prevent contamination of groundwater, and we try and issue permits that are going to do that, and I think that's kind of where we are at this point in time. Now, our approach has been to look at each one of these facilities individually as we permit them and look at the conditions that are happening there and compare those to the data that we have. We have put in place around the demo landfills, through the guidance as a requirement, monitoring wells to take a look at the potential there. We put an up gradient monitoring well to test for background levels so that we know what's in the water already, and then we test down gradient wells to make sure that we understand the impact of the landfill itself. We do have situations where there are other activities in the area that we take into account as we evaluate that as well. So the guidance has put in place a monitoring network around these facilities to look at the data from the facilities. We thought, I think as most folks did, when we put these types of materials in these unlined landfills, that we weren't going to have a groundwater contamination issue. But as we've seen over time, we have an issue with the materials that are going in there. We've looked at it from a couple different standpoints. We've looked at it from the actual facilities. We've also compared it to other data from other states. We've compared it to our data from lined landfills that are accepting basically the same materials. And we're still finding the contamination issues associated with the demolition debris that's impacting groundwater if it's in an unlined facility. So we need to make sure we're not impacting that groundwater, and we've got adequate monitoring around these facilities to start with to at least give us a trigger an idea that something's happening. We may have to investigate that further to understand the exact impacts. We know where they're, you know, our drinking water wells, and we want to make sure we sample those if they're close to the facility to make sure that's not impacting if we realize there's something in these groundwater wells. And we look at the best ways to reduce that release. And I think that starts with the facility itself, how it's designed and how it's managed. You know, we know that the best way to limit this problem is by limiting water that actually comes through the landfill. That's carrying things along or causing chemical reactions underneath to liberate additional chemicals out of the soil that's already there. So we've got two ways that it can get through, and the best way for us to stop that is by reducing the water that comes through to begin with. So we've talked about the best management practices, and I think these facilities are doing a fantastic job. They're doing the best that they can with what's available. They use screening that's there. They take a look at every load, and they put stuff aside that needs to go to a different place. A lot of the facilities have the luxury of having an MSW line landfill adjacent, so they can move it there. Others don't. There are also recycling opportunities for some of the metal and some of the other things, and so we want to make sure that that happens. We limit the amount of waste that's exposed to the elements, the open face of the landfill itself, so that that's reduced in size and so less water comes through it at any time. We want to make sure that they divert stormwater so that doesn't come through. So these are the best management practices that we've looked at. But this material's in place, and we can't dig it up and move it somewhere else. So the only design element we've got left is to look at what can we do when they close and cover the facility to prevent the landfill from getting additional water through it. So that's the thing that we're talking about with the individual facilities now. It doesn't deviate from the guidance. It doesn't deviate from the rules. The guidance didn't anticipate this kind of a problem from the material into the groundwater. So now we look back at the rules, and the rules say, if you've got a release, you've got to take an action to reduce it. So we proposed with the facilities an action that we can look at in dealing with these and getting these facilities re-permitted. So without that option, and I think we have to look a little closer at the language, what it says, we're going to still need to address these landfills and work with them to solve the problem. And I think that's where we're also spending a lot of time, and the chair mentioned time with talking about it here, but also out in the field. We've traveled to the counties and sat with the counties and their consultants and talked through ideas on how we can manage the problem that we have there. So with that, that's the process that we're using. We've based it off of the existing rules and off of the guidance that we have, but the anticipation of what to do with the problem is where we really, I think, have the issue with our landfills right now.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I want to build on what Director Behnke talked about, our practice moving forward, and compare that to the legislation and where we have problems with the legislation. As talked about, there are best management practices that landfills are doing. Some of that screening in the beforehand. But the big part that we still have a difference of opinion when we get into permitting is the enhanced cover piece, to keep the water out, to keep the contaminants that are in the landfill from spreading to the groundwater or stop those chemical reactions which are causing other types of problems. And Part A of the bill talks about these things cannot be done unless already in current rules or the guidance. And that's where we have... We believe this bill will create confusion and the assumption that it prevents the agency from requesting enhanced cover or other type of corrective actions to deal with releases. And when we're talking about releases and when we're looking to do this, it's where we have monitoring data from the landfill, from their consultants using their independent labs, showing that contaminants, whether it's arsenic, manganese, boron, and sometimes vinyl chloride and others, are above the Department of Health's health values. Health values that if it was in an individual well, the Department of Health would send a well advisory to the homeowner saying, don't drink this water. And so we know there's the release there, and we need to move forward and look at corrective actions to limit this release.
as required under statute. So our concern is that the bill creates an assumption that it isn't in rule that those requirements, or that because it may add some cost to it, that it can't be required when that's not what rule and guidance outlines. The second part is, in B, is we believe and agree with the idea of aggregating all this data into a report. We've been working with the solid waste administrators and landfill operators, and we've got a page full of questions that this report should answer, and we're going back and forth to make sure that we have the right questions that are being answered. Our concern with the language here is it, especially the first sentence, talks about developing sampling protocols, and it makes it appear to us that we would have to create a second set of sampling protocols above and beyond what already the labs are using, and that the agency would need to go out and collect this data prior to doing the report. One, we believe this is a duplication of materials that are out there already, including lab techniques and that are being used by the consultants of the landfills, but also concern that this is data that's already been coming in for years, three times a year, from landfill operators. We want to rely on that instead of having to go out and do additional sampling, because we believe that would make it difficult for the November 1st deadline to meet. And we appreciate the chair's willingness to have consideration of pushing that date out possibly to February 1st of 2019 to do the report. We just want to make sure we do justice to the list of questions, and that will take time to go back and forth and get that data together. At the end of the day, as Director Benke and others have mentioned, we have never met a county commissioner or a landfill operator that wants to pollute their water. And so we have those same goals. We do have a difference of opinion on how to go about in reaching those goals. I know there's discussions about, unless rules are revised and how we build these systems in the future. But even if we jump 10 years into the future, and we have collaboratively with the landfill operators and the state and public and private entities come up with a new set of way of how we want to handle solid waste, C&D landfills, we come back to the same problem we're facing today. We have landfills that at their boundaries are releasing contaminants at above Department of Health values. We're going to have to deal with that then or now. We can deal with it now and save costs. The longer it happens, the greater risk that it spreads further and there's additional costs. The cost of installing covers and that into the future, which are required of all landfills when they eventually close, will go up. And so we understand and realize cost is a real issue, and we'd like to work with the various entities to find resources to be made available to help out in these situations, because they are value, the C&D landfills, to local communities. That's why in last year's budget there were dollars in the MPCA budget request for this type of work. With that, I'm open to any questions. Sure. Thank you.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you. I want to go back to the question of, and you're starting to get at it, that the contamination does not stop at the border of the land that is owned by the county, but it can go to the next door neighbor. So now the next door neighbor has groundwater that is not passing the health tests. So the value of the next door neighbor's land has just dropped precipitously. So that feels to me like a unconstitutional taking of somebody's property, because if their drinking water source, which is the groundwater, is no longer any good, the value of their land has just dropped a lot. So have you all talked to counties about their long-term liability here and their responsibility and their taking issue?
To the testifiers, and Mr. Schrader, I'm going to ask you to come down and have a seat next to the witness table at this time, too, in case there's other things.
Mr. Chair and, yep. And committee members, in those situations we have dealt with landfills, there's a number of landfills in various phases. Some of them have already been having to test neighboring private wells, and we've been working with specifically one landfill operator to put in treatment systems as a result of it. Others, landfills are testing private wells as we speak because of our concerns. The level of investigation and work done on these is not nearly as far as some of our other contaminated sites or even our closed landfill programs. We have the data now showing it at the boundaries of the monitoring well that we have those releases over Department of Health values, and we're now spreading out to go and look at that. There really are two aspects of dealing with this. One is stopping the release at the facility, and enhanced cover is one way we believe we can minimize that in a cost-effective way versus digging it up and putting on a liner or expensive pump and treat systems. So we're looking at that. In general, the liability questions, we, you know, talk to counties about what it means if their contamination is found off-site. I wouldn't say that we've necessarily had a meeting just on liability questions.
Like to follow up, Mr.
Representative Joaquin, yes?
I think that, I mean, our original testifier said it's a question for the lawyers, that it would be good to, I mean, we have talked about this in a rather narrow frame, and it would be good to have conversations about the legal ramifications of contaminating somebody else's property and what that means in terms of takings. So I think that would be good, and perhaps as part of this bill that we, if it goes forward, that we make sure those kinds of conversations are set up, that in the long run, people might be thinking, I want to do this a little bit differently if my neighbors can sue me on a takings issue.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, do you have any comments? You said earlier that, and I know this, I mean, I live out there, okay, and we don't want these things to happen, okay? I understand the concern, and it's a legitimate concern, but how do we get to these things, and how do we get these things re-permitted, and how do we keep the debris, the demo debris, in the stream that we want it to be in and not thrown out someplace else? And it's very complicated. And Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. And I, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this would be, I think maybe for Mr. Schrader. Do these demolition landfill operators have specific training and how to handle and remove, you know, these items like asbestos and lead and other problem materials?
Mr. Schrader, you've touched on this briefly before, but go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. Every operator and operator is required to maintain a certification. They go to an initial training, and then every 3 years that certification is renewed with continuing education. Those trainings are put on by the MPC.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. And, I guess the name maybe for Mr. Kudelka, have you monitored this, and are you comfortable with the level of expertise that these operators have?
Commissioner Kadaka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think I'm going to need to call a colleague down. She can talk more about the operator training for landfills, but also further upstream piece regarding how do we oversee the demolition of buildings that deal with asbestos and other pieces of the property of a property deconstruction. It is a system, and there's many components to it. I'm going to ask down our supervisor some of our programs.
Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Chair and Committee. My name is Heidi Cronin,
yep.
And I work with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency out of the Duluth Regional Office. And my position is I work with the Solid Waste Management Unit, which is primarily the Compliance and Enforcement Unit.
Representative Hornstein, would you like to repeat your question, please?
Yeah, just are you, what is the level of participation in these seminars and other training items that you do for these operators?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's primarily up to my group to help facilitate all of the trainings that go on throughout the state. We work with the certified training unit to put on these actual trainings and conduct them. So we have hands-on, you know, work with these trainings every year.
Representative Hornstein.
And just last question. So are you satisfied with the participation level? in terms of these workshops and trainings that you do?
I'm not sure what you mean, satisfied with participation.
I mean, do you have a lot of involvement among the operators and the others in terms of what you're trying to do in terms of, you know, ensuring, you know, certification, qualifications, standards are being met?
Yeah,
yes.
If I may.
Yep.
If I may further address that, thank you. It's our certification. They're required to be there, you know, once every 3 years or at least get their continuing education credits. The training does not specifically train the certified landfill operator to recognize or be able to recognize asbestos-containing material or lead-based paints, items like that. It's in general to pull out unacceptable materials that you can see visually. And they do the best they can with that said. But they're not trained to determine what is suspect material as far as asbestos goes or making the determination if there's lead-based paint on a piece of board or whatever may come in.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Clark Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Oh. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kudelka, thank you for the explanation about the enhanced covers. I'm learning a little bit from you today. My question is specific to the bill, and I understand better the value of the enhanced covers. What in this bill, how does this retard the implementation of the enhanced covers?
Commissioner Kudelka.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, it talks about unless certain things are required under current rules, and our concern is that the first language sets up a situation that make it sound like that if things are additional costs or may have those economic drivers that they may not be put into a permit. However, then the second part of it says that the agency then can impose things that are under rule. And so it creates a situation where I think there's unreal expectations that if the bill is passed, the agency will not be able to ask for enhanced cover through permitting or other methods. And that's where we have the concern is because it's specifically in various parts of statute and rules. Rule 7035-2825 talks about corrective actions must be implemented to repair any conditions not in compliance with our general provisions dealing with solid waste facilities, or talking about sampling and analysis of groundwater must be completed in accordance with other parts of the statute. And specifically, 7035-2565 states the owner and operator must take corrective actions as necessary to end continuing releases and to minimize or abate any resulting groundwater or surface water pollution. And so our concern is if we take that away from the permitting option and do it during that time where we can set out schedules of compliance, put maybe in a permit that says propose to the agency within a certain period of time, a corrective action, that it takes away the permit to do that. What it then does is the rules are still on the books, whether it's then just pushes it into a compliance and enforcement discussion or some of our other contaminated site cleanup programs under MRLA or other types of statute, which puts us in a much different conversation and I'm afraid a less productive conversation than if we work this through on the permitting side where we are able to have consultants say, for instance, this is my site. We think this type of enhanced cover with a durable barrier of their selecting and then enough cover to protect it against the elements, given that winter is still here, those type of things that we can continue to work on in that relationship is much more productive than us having this conversation through a compliance and enforcement setting or our other contaminated sites cleanup programs.
Representative Clark Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is really for you. I'd like to know your thoughts on that. It seems to me like an enhanced cover just makes good sense, and that it does address the concerns that Representative Lagunas is raising, which are very real, and I know you appreciate those concerns. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about that, and is there a way to address that part of the implementation of this bill and to adjust it so that we could expect to avoid those compliance issues that Mr. Kudelka is talking about? My guess is, knowing you, that you don't like that end of it either. So have you thought about that? Is there some room to move on that?
Well, I've thought about this entire issue a lot for a couple of years. And I'll go back to what we've
Mr. Schrader has said and what Mr. Pawlowski has been here and testified in the past couple of years, we all want to get to the right place. It's just a matter of how do we get there. And in terms of enhanced covers, I don't know that there's necessarily a great deal of opposition to enhanced covers. Sometimes it boils down to what's the definition. What's the conversation that's going on about this? Commissioner Kanelka talks about being less productive. I think that up until now it's been very unproductive, okay? And what I'm trying to do is help the people who are experiencing a great deal of frustration, particularly in rural Minnesota, with re-permitting. They have felt like we're going outside of the rules. So there's an interpretation. What's in the guidance document? What's not in the guidance document? What's in the rules? What's not in the rules? What authority do local people have? What authority does the state have? And I would think that, and I've talked to the agency about this, there's been probably a lack of communication, you know, in the past few years about what we're going to do, what the expectations are, what's in the guidance, what's in the rules. And what I'm trying to do is move the ball towards people getting together and figuring out just how can we tackle a very serious problem in rural Minnesota. I'm not saying that this bill, as amended, is the end-all be-all, but I want the conversation to continue so that when we get to a point to where a demolition landfill closes, because it's no longer financially feasible to operate it, what are we going to do? And that's a very real possibility. And so we've had conversations about how to get to a better place, what is an enhanced cover. I think there's a sense in the people that I've talked to that it's a one-size-fits-all for all enhanced covers. And what you need in southeastern Minnesota versus northeastern Minnesota versus northwestern Minnesota could be different things. So I'm not, and Representative Green's hair is probably going to stand up on end here when I do this, but, you know, there's a certain amount of desire within the rural demo landfill operators, which, by the way, Representative Hornstein, you talked about the people that administer these things, the environmental administrators. People that live in rural Minnesota can tell you that in the morning they might put on their environmental administrator cap, and then at 10:30 they take that off and they put on their highway transportation cap, and then they take that off and they put on some other inspector's cap, and then they take that off and put on another cap that they have to do. These counties are stressed. Representative Axelman, I know, in Cooch County, and we're just trying to figure out how can we make everybody happy, how can we get everybody into compliance, and how can we pay for this stuff. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm committed to continuing conversations, getting to a better place, but it's imperative for me to represent the people that have sent me to St. Paul. And these are the frustrations that they have. So MPCA says one thing, the landfill operators say something else. How are we going to get this worked out? Gentlemen, how are we going to get this worked out? Okay? So that's what I'm, and I have taken these things into consideration. So, you know, I wish I had the magic powder that I could sprinkle on it and make everything good. But there are some very real realities to what happens if the demo landfill closes. What happens if we do have water that's impaired because it exceeds the Department of Health's limits? And we need to work on these things and get to a better place. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate what you're talking about. I think if we have a problem where you have to drive the extensive miles to dump, yeah, I agree with you. We will find that in places that will be found 10 years later, et cetera, and there's a lot of places to hide it. But I do think on the enhanced cover there might be some room to move, and I'm going to push you a little bit on it. I heard Mr. Benke say we take it as a case-by-case basis. And so your concerns about it, the enhanced cover in your county may be different than would be down in my area of the state, that the PCA is already taking that into account. And I think there might be some room to move here. And that seems to me a particularly important part because that affects the concerns about groundwater. And when you're, you know, if you, anybody who has a contaminated well is in a bad place. And if we can address that, but at the same time provide some flexibility going forward, I think you might get a little closer to where you want to be. I'm trying to help you, Representative Fagan.
I know you are. I like that. One brewing to another brewing. Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Kudelka, Director Behnke. My question is on the first number I heard, there's 67 or 60-some demolition landfills in the state. Is that correct? I hear that in testimony this morning?
Class 1 demolition landfills. Yep.
Okay.
If you really want to give me the right number, Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have 88 C&D online landfills. 67 have groundwater monitoring. Okay. And of that 67, 63% have seen one contaminant at least that exceeds this Department of Health values.
Representative Kudelka, excuse me. I'm not sure who's taking offense at that.
We're switching places here, I guess.
Take whoever you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So of those numbers, how many of them are privately owned versus publicly owned demolition landfills?
Assistant Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in terms of the online C&D landfills, 43 of them are private and 44 are public facilities, and there is one military facility.
Representative Eckler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you seeing a reduction in numbers of private demolition landfill operators that are deciding it's not worth the hassle and they're closing it up?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members, no, we're not really seeing a reduction. We've actually entertained some new facility applications where we've had some long conversations about what the future looks like for online demos. So I don't think that we have, you know, during the current, but I think the issue is out there, that what does the future hold and what are the costs hold and whether folks will remain in operation. So I think it's a real issue that we have to make sure that the capacity is there, and we share that concern with the counties and with the chair as well in solving this issue.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Chair. Well, just a final comment on that. I know in the county I'm from, there is a private demolition landfill owner that is either closing up his demolition landfill or has done it. And when we had a fire in a building that, and he was asbestos covered or whatever you want to call it, when they had to dispose of that building, if that landfill hadn't been there at the time, it would have been a huge cost to Coochin County to ship that material somewhere else. And so my concern is if these things are getting so stringent on these private ones, it's going to put a bigger load on the system. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And just to finish my comment from earlier, when I talked about Representative Green, I don't remember if I got to. Maybe we need to go to rulemaking. I'm not sure on this, but that's what some of the people outside are asking for, because they haven't done the revision on the rules for quite some time. Representative Wagenius again.
Two things. Just a note. I don't think insurance companies will insure these landfills anymore. Am I right about that, Mr.
Chair? To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you are correct. Insurance companies, landfills now work on a financial assurance system for those MSW landfills, our trash landfills.
So, so that does mean that counties, half of these are then liable, the county taxpayers are kind of on the hook, if you will, for the contamination of the next door neighbor. And if I were a county, I would be worried about that. I'm not going to worry about the private operators. They know what they're in for, but I am worried about the county liability. But on another note, your testifier said, if I heard correctly, that folks are not trained to identify lead covered wood. I mean, old houses, old buildings, they're going to have lead on them. But the testing for that is really quite easy. And it seems to me that every operator should be trained and have the testing right there on site to be able to do a little prevention here, test that paint. It's lead-based. No, it can't go here. Not lead-based. Okay, put it there. Why aren't we doing that?
Mr. Schrader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I probably stumbled over my words because the operators do go to...
Speak into the microphone, please.
It wasn't you I was talking about. It was...
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was the PCA testifier.
Okay. Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair, members, the idea with the identification of the materials goes upstream before the actual facility is demolished. Identify those materials that you might anticipate and test for before it gets, you know, actually demoed. When it comes to the facility, it becomes a lot more difficult to identify components, remove components, and therefore it's not that, you know, it's assumed that there's going to be a look at things, especially asbestos, up front. And it gets tested and then abated before the building would become coming to the demo landfill.
And it's certainly hard to see what's at the bottom of one of the roll-offs and stuff that come to these sites. So, Representative Wagenius.
Nonetheless, one of the issues we have heard here is tornado comes through, fire in a building. That's not been checked upstream. So it does seem to me that PCA does need to incorporate into its training easy checks for operators, because this is not expensive. I mean, checking is not expensive, and they can do this. I mean, we've been hearing about how operators are so responsible, but if they don't have the tool that they need, then they don't have the tool that they need, and that is, if we're going to try to prevent this problem from happening, lead is one of the easiest things to deal with, and it's probably one of the most ubiquitous.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that just to point out, in our sampling, we have not seen lead in any of the monitoring wells. So while we agree that the risk, human health risk of lead is high, we are not seeing that once it is in the landfill that it's causing this problem. I understand that the larger need of
in the
lead.
Future, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Okay. Anything else? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, and I'm not sure who can best answer this. One of the common practices now that we see when we do demolition is typically there'll be a huge veneer grinder there, and for the ease of transportation, after they've done the appropriate things to identify what they can send to whatever landfill, they're gonna grind that stuff and put it in a 12-yard dump truck. So I would ask for how would you anticipate then when that shows up that we would expect the landfill operator to go through 30 tons of ground up material? How practical is that to make that at the absolute that they're going to have to go back and really retest everything that comes in? I mean, is that, are we really, is that practical, particularly with the propensity of this day to grind for a lot of reasons and deliver it that way?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair, members, that's, I think, really helping to provide a point of how difficult that is. And I think that's our point, to go upstream before the building gets demolished and make sure and assure that materials that go into that grinding aren't those that are objectionable. And we haven't dealt with a lot of the grinding until recently with transportation discussions about moving things around. And we're having internal discussions about how we assure that. But one of the ways to do that is prior to the demo landfill accepting the material, get assurance from who's ever providing that they've done that and gone through that, and then create that accountability chain there.
Thank you. The different line of inquiry here. Periodically, I know over the number of decades, we've tried to do some global examination of the requirements or needs out there based on the anticipated future construction and demolition and remodeling and that type of stuff. Do we have recent data to give us some volumetric concept of what we're going to deal with over the next 10 or 20 years? My concern, the reason I say this, is we're already running stuff halfway across, more than halfway across the 70, 80 mile wide county just to find authorized landfill. And so do we have a real up-to-date, forward-looking concept of how many cubic yards of capacity we need out there?
Representative Lewick, I'm impressed. Volumetric, that's pretty good. To the testifiers,
Mr. That's Chairman. Science, and I'm curious about health and safety.
Mr. Chairman and members, that's a really important question. I believe the value in knowing what's in your waste stream and what type of components you have, from whether it be demo or MSW or industrial. And we're continually looking at that. We are looking at that from a construction and demolition standpoint now. And the reason for that is there's three things you can do with waste. You can prevent it from, happening. You can manage it, or you can clean it up. And I think our conversation here is trying to make sure our management doesn't turn into cleanup, and also starts to help people look at these materials for potential reuse, potential recovery, and see what's there, and encourage that as well.
Generally, just as a follow-up, though, when we look at this, for example, the 80-some systems that are out there right now, and their likely capacity, because I understand that's part of the permitting process, is you have to sort of draw a circle around how much room do you have here to store this stuff. Does that match 10-15 years down the road with the anticipated requirements out there? Because most places we either preserve old buildings and turn them into museums, or we replace them with new buildings, and that even without Mother Nature intervening, is a natural process that goes on all over. And I guess I'm just concerned that we're really forward looking here, because that's a huge math problem to try to figure out. Are there some even bigger issues down the road? Because if you start seeing this shrink, and we're going to continue to have to dispose of material, if we don't parallel that, we're going to get in big trouble, or maybe in bigger trouble than we already are.
Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Mankey.
That is, I think, the other part of the equation that we have to be aware of, is what is the capacity to manage these materials, whether it's recycling or disposal, and make sure we have enough, and that it is, as has been suggested here, within the means of the citizens of the Minnesota and of the counties, and make sure that we aren't driving things out, but at the same time balancing that with the environmental protection that we have to do.
Representative Uglum, I'm sorry, just one quick
comment is I do know from part of the state that I live in that they seem to be doing somewhat different things in other states. Now, I'm not saying that Minnesota's doing things better or worse than another state, but I do note that there's a different set of dynamics if you've got a disposal situation close to a state border, depending on what state it is. And I know up in the Duluth area, there's a significant industry on the other side of the St. Louis River in Wisconsin that is a major part of what happens to a whole lot of variety of waste, not necessarily this specific kind. But can you address that a little bit? I mean, if you're sitting in the middle of the state and you can't go to North or South Dakota or Iowa, and you have problems with the system in Minnesota, then you talk 150, 200 miles. Now, I sense that there is a little difference in options if you are close to at least some of these state borders.
All right, so to that point, I would say I'm not sure that I want Badger Kadelka to answer this question. And I thought it was the St. Croix River, but no, I'm kidding. To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee member.
Oh, he's answering it anyway.
You're right, there are different regulations that are across state borders. A number of states are facing the same issue. A number of states, such as Wisconsin and Illinois, require C&D landfills to be lined and have leachate collection systems. So actually, it's more expensive to bring waste over in Wisconsin for C&D situations. Just a quick check on a facility that's along the border in Rush City, we have not seen waste then coming from Wisconsin to Minnesota because of that difference in cost. So there are those differences, and we are like states like Ohio, looking at this in the same spot where we do have these online facilities and trying to create that balance.
Okay, thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief in view of the clock here and everything else, but I did want to provide a little background about the lead paint issue and things. I think many of you know I spent 35 years in the manufacturing industry of paint and coatings here in Minnesota, and I can tell you of the millions of gallons of paint that we produced, never made 1 gallon of lead-based paint. The federal government outlawed the production of lead-based paint in 1978. But in reality, way before that, technology made lead-based paint obsolete because of the white that you see in this paper or in paint or whatever is an invention by DuPont called titanium dioxide, and it's used in paint, it's used in white shirts, it's used in just about anything you see, and it is mined out of the ground. It's simply a sand that is bleached and made white. Most of the pigments that are used in paints are mined out of the ground. Calcium carbonate, limestone, silica sands, and things like that, and various other clays are used in the manufacture of paint. So, realistically, and my family goes back to just after World War II in manufacturing of paint, after World War II, to make lead-based paint for houses was uneconomical. Now, that's not to say that some industrial products, particularly farm implement enamels and other things like that, weren't lead-based until 1978. But for houses, it was a declining portion of the market. And I urge you to just go to your home center or Hirschfield's, a little ad there for the boys, and look on the shelf. It's all water-based paints, and it has been for some time. So the industry has changed because of technology. And that's not to say there aren't a few cases of lead in old houses yet, but it's declining rapidly. And in a few more years, I doubt it will be much of a problem. I'll be happy to talk to any of you offline about any of that anytime. Thank you.
Well, there's your primer on paint today. Can I have another cup of coffee, please? Bernstein caught that one, too. That's pretty good. Not bad for a city boy. Okay. Any other discussion, closing comments on our House File 4070 as amended? Mr. Schrader, please.
Yeah.
And I was going to encourage you, you heard some of the testimony from NPCA, and there's some things that you would like to refute. Here's your chance to do that, but otherwise, closing comments.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. And just a couple of four examples. Lyon County does operate a Class 1 online demolition landfill. We do the required groundwater monitoring, and every so often we get a spike in arsenic in one of our groundwater wells. But that spike is not persistent. The next time we sample, or maybe the next year we sample, we don't come up with arsenic in elevated levels again. And so that speaks to our push for having a better understanding of what actually the connection is between these online demolition landfills and the groundwater sampling. And just another point on that I think Director Benke made a very good point that as groundwater passes through the waste into the, or as the percolation passes through into the groundwater, it does, a chemical reaction can liberate some of the native parent materials that could cause that spike. The same thing could be happening at compost facilities, at yard waste sites, but we don't know that because we don't require groundwater monitoring at those locations. And so our understanding of the groundwater data is very essential. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka mentioned that of the 88 demo landfills, the 67 that have groundwater monitoring, that 63% of those have had some type of elevated levels measured, and if our site is included in that list, it's an occasional, intermittent, not a persistent situation. And so having that data summarized to digest that is very important. And then just one other final point, Mr. Chair and Commissioners, with the enhanced daily cover, some of the numbers that we've seen in the permitted community thrown around by MPCA include a total of five feet of soil material over top of the waste to try to prevent that percolation. We completely agree with MPCA that managing that percolation of rainwater through the waste, that's essential to best management of the site. What 5 foot of cover would do for my facility, for example, if I've got roughly a 400 by 100 foot mound of waste, that 5 foot is going to cost me about $500,000 to import in, because I don't have clay or soil material at my demolition landfill site. And those numbers are based on what we pay for our highway department to haul yards of material to our MSW landfill site from our demolition landfill site. And so the problem is real in some cases with sites that don't have sufficient cover material, and therefore I am very appreciative of the comments of MPCA and their invitations to engage in further dialogue about how we come up with resolving the situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, my closing comments on the bill is that our conversations continue, and I'll work with Representative Clark Johnson if he wants, and anybody else who has some input on this, but I really am trying to make this a win-win situation. So thank you all. With that, House File 4070, as amended with the DE2 amendment, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Appreciate your input. Next, House File 3679, Representative Green. We have a couple of testifiers, Representative Green. You can do a short, my motion here would be to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. And we do have a couple of amendments we'll get to as you see fit.
Okay.
Members and people listening, quiet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to, if Representative Newberger is okay with it, I'd like to move the A3 amendment and then have the testifiers come up before we discuss the bill.
Okay. All right. So Representative Green has moved the A3 amendment. All those, okay. Would you like to explain the amendment? Who we have here? Mr. Claven and Mr. Peterson. Okay. Let's have them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The amendment, I believe, is brought forth by Representative Newberger, and if I think he's ready to explain the amendment.
Okay. Representative Newberger to the amendment, the A3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Green, for moving this amendment for me. The A3 amendment addresses the groundwater issue. We've been working on this for a number of years, trying to work with the agricultural community in order to get some success here and to relieve some of the regulatory burden that they are facing. What this amendment does primarily is three things. But, Mr. Chair, before I dig into this, I just want to indulge you. We might need, depending on how this reads, I might need to ask you for a friendly amendment. It's a grammatical one-word deletion. I don't know if it's appropriate or not. If you look at line 1.117, If you read the sentence, I think that this was just something that that just needs to be fixed. It says here, it says, groundwater, I'm going to start on 16, groundwater that restricts usage in the area, comma, the commissioner must demonstrate to affected permit holders that any data used to make the decision to restrict the usage supports or verifies the decision. I'm not sure if we need the word that in there. I don't know if that's a stumbling point, if that just makes it ungrammatical. I'm just going to leave that to you. I'm willing to go either way. That's something we can work on. I just don't want that to become a stumbling point. So suffice to say, Mr. Chair, we can get back to that. This amendment does three things. The first thing that this amendment does is if you have a someone that owns a property, such as a family farm, they want to pass it off to their children and their grandchildren, keep it in the family, or sell it to someone that they know. If they have an existing water use permit, that once this, if they are in compliance, if they're, everything is fine and they want to transfer this permit to the person that they're selling the property to, that the commissioner cannot come back and require additional testing or other conditions here when they transfer the permit, as long as we have a pre-existing permit that's already in compliance. So basically, don't add additional rules to something that isn't already, something that didn't broke, don't fix it. Number two would be the groundwater management plans that starts on line 115, subdivision 6. It's basically that if before the commissioner approves a groundwater management plan or modifications to the plan for appropriating groundwater that restricts the usage in the area, the commissioner must demonstrate to the affected permit holders the data that they use to make that decision. What we are having here, Mr. Chair and members, is that there are some cases that that I've been made aware of where there has been some changes, but the data, where they restrict the use, but the data, there's no data. It's just, it's basically do what we say and we're not going to show you the data. So I think this is just, this is really good transparency on behalf of the agency to just back up what they say with the information. And then finally, the third part of what this amendment will do is that before the commissioner approves a groundwater management plan or modification to the plan for appropriating groundwater, the commissioner must consider the economic impact of the plan modification. Folks, I mean, as we all know, this committee covers a lot of issues in a lot of areas. Farming is one of the primary economic drivers of our state. The amount of water that a farmer, an irrigator, is allowed to use is directly proportional to the productivity of their farm. And if we are going to restrict the amount of water that they can use, we are definitely going to put them in a situation where we could be lowering their productivity, their economic livelihood. So it's very important that the commissioner, in these cases, considers the economic impact of any plan modifications. Those are the three big things in my bill. And as going back originally to the little technical fix, I don't see that that's necessary. My inner grammatical person gets a little sensitive sometimes when I'm reading these things. Suffice to say, that's the amendment, and I stand for any questions. I do have a couple of testifiers here to testify on behalf of this amendment, but also on behalf of the bill, Mr. Parkins and Mr. Peterson and Mr. Clavin are here, and these guys are resident experts.
Thank you. Well, just real quickly, Ms. Taylor. Well, and Representative Neuberger, I'm a little surprised in your opening on this one. You started talking about the word that. You used the expression, you say you're going to dig into the amendment. I'm surprised you didn't say you're going to drill down into the amendment. But to the point about the word that,
Mr. Chair, members, I would recommend leaving that unless we want to get rid of
that.
Yeah, leaving in the word that. Unless the intent was to just have the commission provide the information, then perhaps not using the term demonstrate and use provide, and then you could get rid of the term that.
Now we've heard that.
That makes sense to me.
Okay, good. All right.
I will withdraw any technical.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that we don't have any stumbling points here.
to the amendment. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question or concern I have is under the economic impact. It sounds like what I'm trying to get understanding is this trying to set a little different prioritization is how allocation of permits is being done.
To the author of the amendment, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, the authorization of how these permits are being, of course it would. This would have to, I mean, if you're going to be talking about someone's livelihood here, if you're talking about farmers who are in bad years or farmers who are just starting out, they're on razor thin margins. Of course, it's going to affect us, and it should. We should have this discussion, and the commissioner should take this into consideration. Why are we going to put hardworking farmers out of business without even considering the economic impact of these decisions?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think the unintended consequences that your amendment may have may actually do what you're trying to avoid. And what I'd like to do is reference Section 103G.261, Water Allocation Priorities. Right now, when the DNR allocates water permits, the number one priority is domestic drinking water supply. Number two is the water consumption of less than $10,000 a year, which is basically the small private wells of homes throughout the state. The third priority is agriculture irrigation. So after domestic water drinking, the next priority is agriculture. So if you're saying you want to take the economic priority into account, then what you're saying is you're going to put domestic drinking water at risk. Then below that are other businesses and other industrial uses. And so what could end up happening is with the bill you're proposing, if, say, you had a new business coming into an area with 5,200 jobs using that economic impact, they could say instead of the agriculture use, which is a higher priority getting the water, now a business would get that water, which is a lower priority. And because of how we're looking at water priorities here, I think we've got a much bigger discussion, much more wide-ranging impact, and I don't think that's really appropriate at this point in the session, and we need a lot more discussion and study before we enter into this, and I would say that for your Amendment 3, we'd be best off putting it off at this point in time, because I think we could spend a lot of time talking about water priority uses and the unintended consequences that could actually have in actually hurting agriculture.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to speak a little bit here. I'm not an expert, and I'll make that clear. So if someone else wants to come down and correct me, they can. But as I understand the law, there's monitoring going on all the time. And should the water levels fall and should there be impact on private wells, then the DNR has the authority to come in and shut the irrigators down. So there's protections in place for that already. And I think we're covered there.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a concern I'm raising here is with the A3 amendment. If this A3 amendment comes in, then that starts trumpeting the abilities that the DNR has right now if they have to take the economic consideration into effect. And as a result, this is why I'm thinking we've got a bigger area, and I'd like to have, as we get into this, is hear more from the DNR and the implications of this.
Comments? Mr. Clayton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, can you hear me up there?
Yep.
Irrigators Association. Representative Neuberger did my role this morning, which was to walk through the amendment, so I just have a little bit to add on this discussion. And to let members know, too, I talked to Mr. Meyer about this a couple times. I know that the DNR's chief issue is the economic impact discussion on lines 1.19 to 1.21. So we're going to keep talking about that. Just to refresh members, last year we were here with we had a bill that Representative Neuberger had. We had five things in there. I think we ended up with about two and a half of them in May by the time we got all done. What we asked for last year was an economic study with some results and some recommendations, and that was not their area. And Mr. Meyer and I talked about that. Mr. Johnson with the cities also raised that issue, so that was dropped from the bill early last year. What we're trying to get at here is to ask the department when they make the decision, like Representative Neuberger said, to restrict use or shut it down, could you at least consider the economics? Can you at least look past and see what will happen? They take a number of things into account. Sustainability is somewhere in 103G. There's no definition of it, but it's something the department considers. They consider impacts on fens, trout streams, negative impacts, They consider many things, and all we're saying is you at least look at the number. And that's what this section is trying to get. If we wanted to tamper with Section 261, the priorities, we'd have that section in here. So I get the point that Representative Fisher is making. That's not our intent here at all. We know about the priorities. That's what the discussion is. Just consider it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fisher, a follow-up?
I don't have any follow-up questions at the point. I know there's others that want to talk. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I got Lewick, Swadzinski, Wagenius, and Brian Johnson.
Going back to Section 1, Subpart 7, and I guess any of the testifiers, if they could kind of answer this to make sure I'm understanding the line that they would be at is basically we're talking about a irrigation permit that is in force. There are no violations. The equipment, the operation of it is doing no harm. Yet the owner simply, for whatever reason, takes a piece of what would appear to be their property and transfer it. Why would we go back that opportunity, take that opportunity as an agency? Is that, does the agency come back and say, you know what, since we noticed that we have your permit here happens to be in full compliance, we're now going to add some new requirements for that permit? Is that looks to me like what the gut issue is here in that section, and what we're trying to just say, no, don't do that. If you're in compliance, that's a commodity, it's a value. Talk about taking. I think Representative Wagenius mentioned that. That would look to me like a taking of property by simply, because you could very easily add some things that would make it unpractical to sell it or transfer it, or simply to even next person to operate. So, I mean, am I overstating what's going on here and why we've got that line in there?
To the testifiers, see, Mr. Meckel is on deck too, so. Mr. Peterson, identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Alan Peterson. I am president of the State Irrigators Association. I also farm in the Clear Lake area with my oldest son. The reason the line is in there is because the DNR in the past few years has been asking, as land gets transferred, to re-examine the permit. When the permit is in good standing, it's no violations, no issues going on with it other than it was asked for a transfer. And we, like you, have stated that we don't agree with that. If there is no issues with the permit, that we feel it should just transfer. And in a lot of cases, it does. It's not like an epidemic thing, but there are certain areas of the state with certain employees of the state that are asking for this, and that's why we're putting it in.
Representative Lloyd, follow up. And again, I don't want to draw this out into too much painstaking detail, but do we occasionally see a situation that an individual in the community that takes umbrage with what their neighbor's doing on their property completely legitimately, they're breaking no rules, but I guess they could go to the DNR and pressure them over any permits or anything, just like you can go down to the courthouse and complain to the sheriff because you don't like your neighbor. Now, the average folks at the local level will look and go, well, that sounds like a personal problem. As long as you guys don't go out and start wrestling with each other, we can deal with your likes and dislikes. But do we also, I would hope, do we see that circumstance where that permit is used as kind of a push and shove to intimidate somebody, particularly the next new person that may want to continue to farm?
To the testifiers. Mr. Peterson, Mr. Clavin.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, thanks for the question. I don't think, Representative Lulick, we've seen that. We have not heard that from our membership, that particular issue.
Representative Lulick. That's good news. Thank you.
Representative Swadzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, that was kind of going down my for my question is, and I think the testifier spoke to that a little bit, was, you know, from all the transfers that do happen, you know, is there a percentage that are being, you know, pushed back or having different requirements put on it? And, you know, it'd be interesting to find out, you know, have we compiled the data from a cost perspective of, so those permits, well, when there's a transfer happening, you know, those extra asks that are being put on that or denials, has there been any tracking from a cost perspective of what that has done in general?
Testifiers, are you aware of that? Or Manager Meckel, Section Manager Meckel, can you come down, please, too?
Good morning.
Good morning. Jason Meckel, Section Manager, Division of Ecological and Water Resources. I don't know that I have a complete answer to the question about costs on particular transfers, but in terms of denials, the agency has received 5,454 applications in the last 8 years. 406 of those applications were withdrawn by the applicant. 5,036 permits were issued. A total of 12 denials were issued. Most of those denials were associated with calcareous fens. I'm not aware of any denials that were associated with a transfer.
Associated with what?
I'm sorry. A transfer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Neuberger, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. We don't know why those 400 permits were withdrawn. It might have been people that, for whatever reason, we can only speculate, but we did have 12 denials. The case or the issue that we're trying to settle here is that this state has a notorious reputation for regulatory uncertainty. One of the things that that people have coming into this state or trying to develop new jobs within this state is that you never know what you're dealing with. What works in one part of the state can get changed by an employee for an agency at another. So all we're trying to do here is just to establish some regulatory certainty so that we level the playing field, so that you know that if you've got a permit and it's in good standing and you want to send your family farm off to your grandson or your granddaughter, you can do it without having the agency, having the potential of the agency changing the rules and basically shutting it down.
Representative Brian Johnson, and then Wagenius after that.
Mr. Chair, I just have a short comment on this amendment. The way I read this, this is giving certainties to the buyers of the property. If these permits are denied or they're changed, it can greatly change the value of the land that these farmers are purchasing and could affect the loans that they might have to obtain from the bank and the collateral. And without some type of certainty, it can be tough for some of the banks to actually provide the money and a loan to obtain this property.
So just real quickly, we need to get going here quickly, but to the testifiers, whether it's Mr. Meckel or Peterson, what's the difference in the value of the land where you have an operating irrigation system versus not having that there?
Representatives, Mr. Chair, at my farm in Clear Lake, if I was to sell land with an irrigator versus without, the property value would drop in the less than half without the irrigator. If you were selling that property and then could not sell it with an irrigator, it would drop to less than half.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Were you not speaking into the microphone again?
She couldn't hear you.
So, I thought Representative Fisher was right about Section 3. I'm going to talk about Section 1. We're talking about creating regulatory uncertainty. The uncertainty that you're creating with this is for all the neighbors of the person who you're talking about here. So this is a huge uncertainty provision. And the reason I'm saying that is because let's have a situation where there's a permit and it's in good shape, but the aquifer has now gone down a lot. We've had a dry period, particularly in your area. The Mississippi River goes down. Aquifers are going to go down because the water migrates into the Mississippi. The groundwater migrates into the Mississippi. Aquifer is down. So if this farmer gets to keep his or her permit, then you're putting all the neighbors and their neighbors' wells at a disadvantage and creating uncertainty, major uncertainty for them. So you're giving an advantage to one person and taking it from a whole bunch of other people. This is a major change in our law because our law is fair share. Everybody gets a fair share of an aquifer. That's our law. What you're trying to put here is Western water law, where the first in line gets the water. And I don't know that we want to go to Western water law. Just how's that working out for everybody? It's not. So I speak in strong opposition to this as a major change in the way we are handling our water right now, going away from fair share. It's going to actually impact folks in your district, maybe more than folks in Representative Swazinski's district, because you're right next to the Mississippi with a lot of polluted water wells now and very vulnerable to drought. So I speak against this. It's not ready for prime time. I understand people make investments, but this one is a huge change in law.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neuberger, you were sounding kind of senatorial there for a moment. And
well, thank you. I can give you a website you can go to.
Until you start talking about the inner little person talking grammatically, I need to know a little more on that, I guess. But I actually have a question on what happens. You've been referring to transfer between agricultural uses, and what if development is occurring and you have an irrigation well and you're transferring it to development? So we have the well sealing requirements notification requirements now. What happens if the agricultural use with the irrigation well is transferring it for development? How does that work? And maybe you need to phone a friend on that.
Representative Neuberger or Mr. Meckel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will defer this, but it is my understanding that when you're comparing an apple to an orange, because you're talking about a permit that's specific to agricultural use, and now you want to transfer it over to a different type of use, that would be, as far as I'm concerned, it would be a violation of the conditional use of that permit. But I will let people with bigger brains than mine answer this question.
Mr. Meckel, please.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Neuberger, for that compliment. It's a question I hadn't thought about prior to this, but I think your response is right on, that if you change the use category, that changes the permit. It's not a transfer. I would, and I know our time is running short, so if I could just speak to the department's perspective on this. We do have concerns with the language. A lot of the reasons have already been stated. A transfer of a permit without any review of it implies that it's a right. You know, permits in the state of Minnesota are renewed annually as long as they're in good standing until we have such reason as to make a change. Where we are finding these issues occurring is in places where we've got an intensive amount of groundwater use. It's been mentioned before, parts of the state where irrigation is extremely important to agricultural productivity, and we've got irrigation wells next to irrigation wells next to irrigation wells, and in some cases they're interfering with each other. And that's what we're dealing with in resolving those issues. There are very few situations that I'm aware of where on a transfer we have required any additional testing or aquifer tests, frequently is what we refer to them as. In fact, I'm not aware of anywhere an aquifer test was required as a condition on a transfer. But we do take that opportunity to look at it and make sure that this is a water use that we can still authorize and that meets the statutory requirements.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, I know we're running out of time, and there's another awesome amendment coming up, so we're ready to vote here.
Representative Green, this Neuberger amendment, we have to adopt the amendment, okay? So I'm ready to do that. All those in favor of the Neuberger Amendment as presented, signify the A3, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment's adopted. Okay, the awesome amendment, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
I talked to Representative Hansen yesterday about the amendment. Members, the amendment that's before us was actually in the form of a bill earlier in the session, and it was assigned to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform, and it's now before this committee as an amendment. And I'm going to rule that the amendment is out of order. It does not meet the requirements that we have in our House rules. I talked to Representative Hansen about this yesterday. I told him that I was going to rule that the amendment is not germane, and that's going to be the ruling of the chair, but I also did say that I would give Representative Hansen an opportunity to speak to the amendment. The decision of the chair, according to the rules, and I checked with the people way upstairs, and Ms. Taylor, I know, is prepared to answer this. It's the chair's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was looking for the opportunity to move the amendment, so I would move it, and then I think I also mentioned that I could get this done in 2 minutes.
Sure.
This is the governor's proposal on wells and on having disclosure. So currently, with disclosure of wells, when you transfer property, you disclose the well. This would require testing and analysis for bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic. I just had the well on my agricultural property tested for bacteria. Cost $25, got done in 24 hours, no coliform bacteria in the well. So I think it's an easy type of solution. It did not get heard. I wish it would get heard. I understand the chair has ruled it out of order. I would ask to appeal the decision of the chair and roll call the appeal.
It's my understanding, members, that the decision of the chair is not appealable. And Ms. Taylor, I don't necessarily like deferring my decisions to staff. In this case, I'm very happy to do that. And members, I might add that, you know, this would be, someone told me earlier that this would be like asking to put amend a Health and Human Services bill with some musky fishing language or something like that. So, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I'll just read the the applicable rule. It says an amendment offered in committee must be on a subject that is within the jurisdiction of the committee. Whether an amendment is on subject that is within the jurisdiction of the committee is a question to be decided by the person chairing the meeting who may put the question to the committee. So it would be up to you.
And I've decided not to do that. So thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up, if possible, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, House File 3679 as amended, the title of it says Irrigation Test Wells. So it is on wells. It is the bill in front of this committee. The debate we just had for approximately 20 minutes was on wells. And so the amendment I have is relating to wells. I understand the power of the gavel, but I wanted to make that
sure. And this is irrigation wells versus drinking water wells, which are in two completely different sections of law. And that's my decision. Questions? Okay, with that,
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just for the public's benefit, I just kind of wanted to clarify that it is about wells, so it's not quite musky fishing and HHS,
Okay, pheasant hunting.
Maybe pheasant hunting and duck hunting, but just wanted to make that point so people understand, and that those who are listening or watching are aware that it's not as ridiculous as that example. So,
well, and to that point, I would say I don't care to have our bill wind up over in the Health and Human Services Committee after we present our bill, and I'm just not interested in that possibility. So, Representative Wagenius.
Well, with that in mind, are you getting ready to move this bill to the Committee on Agriculture since we have put in irrigation wells?
My intention here is to move lay this bill over, okay, for possible inclusion. and I don't know that it has to go there. Okay? Okay, Representative Green.
All I can say, Mr. Chair, is I'll throw in a plug for you because you mentioned my name earlier. I have no problem if the agencies want to make rules and bring them here for us to codify them. That would be fine with me. And I appreciate the puns you laid out today. You did a very good job, kept the meeting light. But it's a good bill, and if you guys have any other questions on it, I mean, I'd be happy to answer them offline as well. So thank you.
All right, with that, House File 3679 is laid over for possible inclusion. Members, thank you. I appreciate everyone's concerns. You know that. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.